from New York, this is Democracy Now!
We are telling them that they've got to be accountable to us! We are telling them that they've got to pick a side! You either gonna be on the side of Jim Crow, or you gonna be on the side of the people! You can't have it both ways!
Calls are growing to boycott Georgia and Georgia-based companies after Republican Governor Brian Kemp signs what many describe as the worst voter suppression legislation since the Jim Crow era. Delta and Coca-Cola are now speaking out against the restrictions. But is it too late? We'll talk to Cliff Albright of Black Voters Matter about the fight to preserve voting rights across the country. Then to Oregon Governor Kate Brown on her efforts to expand vote by mail, a practice used in Oregon for decades.
Just months after we saw record turnout in the 2020 general election, Republicans are trying to rewrite history by rolling back the gains we've made in expanding vote by mail. It's undemocratic, it's un-American, and I'm taking action.
Plus, we look at the political and pandemic crisis in Brazil. We'll speak to Celso Amorim, who served as Brazil's foreign minister under Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Minnesota, the former police supervisor of Derek Chauvin testified Thursday there was no justification for the ex-Minneapolis officer to keep his knee on the neck of George Floyd for over 9 minutes. Sergeant David Pluger was called by the prosecution in Chauvin's murder trial.
Sir, based on your review of the body-worn camera footage, do you have an opinion as to when the restraint of Mr. Floyd should have ended in this encounter?
Yes.
What is it?
When Mr. Floyd was no longer offering up any resistance to the officers, they could have ended their restraint.
And that was after he was handcuffed and on the ground and no longer resisting?
Correct.
Prosecutors played a recording of a phone call Chauvin made to Sergeant Pluger after Floyd's death, in which Chauvin made no mention of pressing his knee into Floyd's neck for over 9 minutes. Paramedic Dara Smith testified George Floyd appeared to be dead when the paramedic arrived on the scene, with officers still pressing Floyd to the pavement. Smith's partner testified he had to ask Chauvin to get off George Floyd's neck or signal to him so the paramedics could check his vitals when they arrived. Also testifying Thursday was George Floyd's girlfriend, Courtney Ross, who described how the pair fell in love in 2017 after they met at a Salvation Army shelter where Floyd worked as a security guard. Ross described their shared struggle with opioid addiction. Chauvin's defense is focused on Floyd's past drug use in a bid to imply he died of an overdose, not Chauvin's knee. Floyd family attorney Ben Crump responded, quote, "Tens of thousands of Americans struggle with self-medication and opioid abuse and are treated with dignity, respect, and support, not brutality. We fully expected the defense to put George's character and struggles with addiction on trial because that's the go-to tactic when the facts are not on your side," Crump said. Texas's state Senate has passed a voter suppression bill banning drive-through voting, limiting extended early voting hours, and making it illegal for local election officials to send vote-by-mail applications to voters, even if they qualify. The legislation now heads to Texas's Republican-controlled House of Representatives. Meanwhile, religious leaders in Georgia are calling for a boycott of corporations that refuse to speak out against the state's sweeping new voter suppression law, which was signed by Republican Governor Brian Kemp last week. After headlines, we'll have the latest on Republican voter suppression efforts with Cliff Albright, executive director of Black Voters Matter, and the Oregon governor, Kate Brown. Coronavirus cases are continuing an exponential rise across much of the United States, even as the number of U.S. residents who've received at least one dose of a vaccine tops 100 million. On Thursday, the U.S. recorded over 79,000 new cases amidst warnings that a sharp drop in testing may be masking an even greater number of infections. More than 1,000 people died of COVID-19 Thursday. In Washington, D.C., the opening day matchup between Major League Baseball teams, the Washington Nationals and the New York Mets, was called off after at least three Nationals players tested positive for the coronavirus. This comes as President Biden is criticizing the Texas Rangers for planning to open its 40,000-seat stadium at full capacity for the team's April 5th home opener against the Toronto Blue Jays. A UN official is warning Burma could be headed towards civil war and appealed to the Security Council to take action to avoid an imminent bloodbath. At least 543 people have been killed, including dozens of children, in the brutal crackdown on protests following the February 1st military coup. On Thursday, the military junta cut all wireless internet in Burma and charged opposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi with violating the Official Secrets Act. A representative of the ousted civilian government said foreign military intervention was needed. The shadow government has also called for a revolution to counter the military junta and said it would work on forming a unity government and drafting a new constitution. On Thursday, protesters burned copies of the 2008 military constitution on the streets of Rangoon.
I agree 100% with what the committee representing Burma's government in exile is doing right now, as we hope to become a federal army. And as a member of the youth, I would like to join that army.
In Taiwan, a high-speed train carrying nearly 500 people derailed and crashed in a tunnel, killing at least 51 people and injuring dozens more. Many of the passengers were traveling to visit family over the weekend's public holiday. It's Taiwan's worst rail disaster in decades. In Arizona, a new investigation revealed staff at the privately run immigration jail, La Palma Correctional Center, violated multiple pandemic protocols, verbally assaulted prisoners, and attacked prisoners with pepper spray during a peaceful protest. The report by the Homeland Security Department's Office of the Inspector General says La Palma staff failed to enforce mask and social distancing protocols, contributing to a massive spread of COVID-19 cases. The report also found staff often refused to provide medical attention to prisoners and in many cases did not refill their prescriptions, including for a cancer patient who ran out of leukemia medication. In California, Border Patrol agents deported a Honduran asylum seeker to Mexico after she went into labor while in custody. The woman had recently crossed into the U.S. with her partner. She was eventually taken to a hospital south of Tijuana, where she gave birth. President Biden held his first cabinet meeting Thursday and named the heads of five departments, transportation, housing, commerce, labor, and energy, to lead the charge on his recently unveiled $2.3 trillion infrastructure plan. Meanwhile, progressives continue to call for an even greater investment in infrastructure projects. This is New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez speaking on MSNBC.
We're talking about realistically $10 trillion over 10 years. And I know that may be an eye-popping figure for some people, but we need to understand that we are in a devastating economic moment. Millions of people in the United States are unemployed. We have a truly crippled healthcare system and a planetary crisis on our hands, and we're the wealthiest nation in the history of the world.
Another 719,000 U.S. residents applied for unemployment benefits last week, an increase of 61,000 claims over the previous week. Recent unemployment numbers are at least three times higher than pre-pandemic levels, but economists say they're trending downwards as more businesses reopen and more people receive vaccines. Former U.S. intelligence analyst Daniel Hale has pleaded guilty to leaking classified documents about the secretive U.S. drone program. Hale will be sentenced on July 13th for violating one count of the World War I era Espionage Act. He faces up to 10 years in prison. Hale was enlisted in the Air Force from 2009 to 2013, during which he worked with the National Security Agency and Joint Special Operations Task Force at the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, where he helped identify targets for for assassination. Hale is accused of disclosing 11 top-secret or secret documents to a reporter. The indictment does not name the reporter, but unnamed government sources have told media outlets the reporter is investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill of The Intercept. New Mexico's legislature has passed a bill that would legalize recreational marijuana and expunge the criminal records of some individuals convicted of marijuana possession. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham has promised to sign the bill, which would make New Mexico the 16th U.S. state to legalize recreational cannabis. This follows New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's signature Wednesday of a similar bill. In Virginia, Governor Ralph Northam is urging the state's General Assembly to legalize recreational marijuana by July 1st instead of waiting until 2024. Virginia's Supreme Court ruled Thursday the city of Charlottesville can take down two statues of Confederate generals after some residents sued to stop their removal. The statues are of Thomas Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee. Lee's statue was at the center of the deadly white supremacist Unite the Right rally in 2017. More scandals are emerging around Florida Republican Congressmember Matt Gaetz. CNN is reporting Gaetz was known by other lawmakers to regularly boast of his sexual exploits and show nude photos and videos of women he slept with, sometimes showing them on the House floor. Gaetz is currently facing a Justice Department sex trafficking investigation, which includes whether he had sex with a 17-year-old and whether he used drugs and cash payments as part of sexual transactions with women and girls. And over 30 LGBTQ students are suing the U.S. Education Department for discrimination they faced while attending federally funded Christian colleges. Students describe homophobic harassment, including being forced into so-called conversion therapy. Scott McSquain, one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, told Democracy Now! Earlier this week about his experience at the private Union University in Tennessee.
Three staff members, including the dean, told me to go to conversion therapy, told me I would be kicked out if I didn't. I am hoping that all of this educates people that this sort of thing is still happening today in America. And, you know, schools shouldn't be allowed to accept federal money and openly discriminate based off of their specific narrow view of a religious text.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A stunning new report from the Brennan Center for Justice finds Republican state lawmakers have now introduced 361 bills to restrict voting rights across 47 states. Restrictive bills are now moving through legislatures in 24 states, and 29 bills have already been passed by at least one chamber of state houses. Early on Thursday morning, the Republican-controlled Texas Senate approved a bill to limit early voting hours, ban ballot drop boxes, end drive-through voting, and allow poll watchers to videotape voters. This is one of just 49 bills to restrict voting being considered in Texas. This comes just a week after Georgia's Republican Governor Brian Kemp signed a sweeping elections bill that adds new voter ID requirements, severely limits mail ballot drop boxes, and rejects ballots cast in the wrong precinct. One provision would even make it a crime to hand out food or water to voters waiting in line at polling places. Governor Kemp signed the bill behind closed doors below a picture of a slave plantation. He was surrounded by six white men. Democratic State Representative Park Cannon, who is African-American, knocked on Kemp's door, saying the public deserved to witness what was happening. Cannon was then arrested by several Georgia state troopers, dragged through the Capitol, and pushed into a patrol car, even as she shouted that she was an elected official.
Why are you
rights groups blasted the Georgia law as the worst voter suppression legislation since the Jim Crow era. Meanwhile, a number of major corporations are finally speaking out against the crackdown on voting rights. On Thursday, American Airlines, which is based in Texas, announced it's strongly opposed to the Texas bill, as well as others like it. Coca-Cola and Delta, which are both based in Georgia, have come out against the Georgia law, but only after it was signed by the governor. This comes as some are calling for a boycott of the state of Georgia and companies based there. Even President Joe Biden has weighed in, saying he would strongly support Major League Baseball players if they decide to move the upcoming All-Star game from Atlanta in protest. We go now to Atlanta, where we're joined by Cliff Albright, co-founder and executive director of Black Voters Matter. Talk about the significance of this building movement, even, of course, after the bill was signed. Talk about what you're calling for, Cliff Albright.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Amy. Yeah, definitely. We're still calling for corporate accountability from these Georgia companies that, as you said, came out too late to oppose the bill that was here in Georgia. But we always say that it's never too late to do the right thing, all right? So what can these companies do, and what are we demanding that they still do? First of all, right here in Georgia, it's not too late to still deal with this bill that was passed. We're calling for both repeal and divest. We're calling for a repeal of this voter suppression law, and we're calling for these companies to divest future support that they've given. Because at the end of the day, part of the reason we called these companies out, and I'm talking about the companies like Coca-Cola and Delta and UPS, is because not only are they Georgia-based, but they had previously given significant resources to the very sponsors of the voter suppression bills, not just to Republican Party in general, not just to Republican legislators in general, but specifically to the big voter suppressors that were sponsoring these voter suppression bills. And so we're asking them to divest future support, just like there was the call after the January 6th Capitol riot, where some companies said we're no longer going to give to members of Congress that voted to overturn the election. So those are the Georgia-specific concerns. But we're also very much aware and in partnership with these movements in other states. I was just in Texas, as you know, for the past week. And so part of our calls and demands here in Georgia are, one, that these companies aggressively support with concrete actions the passing of H.R. 1 and H.R. 4, because at the end of the day, if those had been in place before this wave of suppression bills that you just talked about, that the Brennan Center has done analysis on, if H.R. 1 and H.R. 4, and again, that's the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, if they were in place, then we wouldn't be having this conversation right now. The other thing that we're asking, in the spirit of recognizing that this is a national movement, is in each of the states where we do our work, we're asking that the coalition acknowledge and call for support for the other states. So right here in Georgia, our demands for Coca-Cola and Delta and the other companies is that they also speak out that they do in the other states what they epically failed to do here in Georgia, that they actually speak out ahead of time, that they get involved in the Texas struggle ahead of time, in the Arizona struggle, in the Michigan struggle ahead of time. These are national companies, in fact, global companies. So they're not just restricted to their home state of Georgia. They can speak out against these other bills as well.
So you have the CEOs for Delta Airlines and Coca-Cola, both based in Georgia, finally coming out in opposition to Georgia's clampdown on voting rights nearly a week after the legislation was signed and amidst mounting public scrutiny and threats to boycott the companies over their inaction. Delta's initial statement Friday read in part, "The legislation signed this week improved considerably during the legislative process and expands weekend voting, codifies Sunday voting, and protects a voter's ability to cast an absentee ballot without providing a reason. For the first time, drop boxes have also been authorized for all counties statewide, and poll workers will be allowed to work across county lines. Nonetheless, we understand concerns remain over other provisions in the legislation. There continues to be work ahead in this important effort." But then, after massive protest, they actually came out stronger, though it was after the passage of the legislation. Yeah. Can you talk about then Kemp taking them on, the legislature threatening to strip Delta of tax protections or increasing the taxes on them, and then the corporate boycott call that would include them?
Yeah. That first statement that you read from Delta was actually right after the bill was signed, and it amounted to basically just gaslighting. It sounds like Governor Kemp, fake Governor Kemp's talking points. But then, as you said, after the pressure that came out, the second statement, which was much stronger, but still late, and now they are facing repercussions. To which, you know, we're saying, look, we want to maybe pull back on some of the challenges and the calls that we were doing on Delta, to acknowledge the fact that they've now come out strongly, to acknowledge the fact that there was an attempt to pass these legislation and repealing of their tax breaks. But at the end of the day, Delta's going to be okay, right? The session ended, and so it ended without that actually being able to get through both chambers of the legislature and being signed by Governor Kemp. It was really more of just a signal coming from the Republicans that, you know, they were displeased with Delta's statement. So, but what we're saying is we need Delta to go even further. And if they do go further, we'll have their back. Right. The same way that we're going to call them out, and not just them, but all of these companies when they do wrong and when they're silent on voter suppression. You know, we'll stand by them if they do the right thing. And so that's what we're asking them and the other companies, and not just the Georgia companies, but the Texas companies and others. That's what we're asking them to do. Stand by the words that you said in the midst of the summer of protests about Black Lives Matter, when you had all these glowing statements about racial justice and racial equity. If you said it back in the summer, now's the time for you to actually put some actions behind it. And each of these companies have some very concrete actions. Imagine if these companies, Coca-Cola and Delta, had made the statements that they came out with the other day. If they had made those statements at hearings when this bill was still being discussed, then we wouldn't be having this conversation right now. If they had said unequivocally what they said in their most recent statements, that this law is unacceptable, both companies said that, this law is unacceptable. If they had said that a week ago, then we wouldn't be sitting here discussing the fact that that bill had actually passed. Imagine if every Fortune 500 company came out with a statement that was as strong as what the black executives, the 72 black executives, came out with the other day on Wednesday in their full page ad in a major newspaper. Imagine if all Fortune 500 companies came out that unequivocally, that passionate, that clear about you. There is no middle ground. There is no both-sidism. And so that's what we're saying to these companies. If they wanted to squash this legislation, it would have been squashed. If they wanted to put their full weight behind H.R. 1 and H.R. 4, then H.R. 1 and H.R. 4 would already be passed. That's what we're demanding of them.
Okay, so let's talk about H.R. 1 and H.R. 4. Explain what each are. And there we're talking about in Congress, in the U.S. Congress, federal laws.
Right. We're talking about, so H.R. 1, the For the People Act, is basically the act that has a wide range, the most sweeping voting rights and voting access bill since the 65 Voting Rights Act. It would deal with, you know, some of the things that are included in this Georgia bill. It would guarantee, you know, days of early voting. It deals with restoration of voting rights. It deals with voter registration processes. It basically would create some standards by which we can actually make the 15th Amendment mean something, right? That we've got this right to vote. And so that's what's included in the For the People Act. And then for H.R. 4, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, is basically the enforcement part. It's the reestablishing parts of the Voting Rights Act that had been stripped away, that had been gutted by the Supreme Court in the Shelby decision back in 2012. Which, by the way, at the time, you know, Justice Roberts, you know, made the case that, oh, the country has changed, right? That you know, we're not seeing these sweeping attacks against voting rights. You know, we've got a black president. And so, you know, here we are in 2021, again, with all of these bills going across 47 states, over 360 bills. And it's not just like it's this year. This has been happening consistently since the gutting of the Voting Rights Act. That's why we need H.R. 4 to restore the Voting Rights Act. If those two bills were actually law, then right now, the vast majority, I think the Brennan Center said this as well, the vast majority of what these state proposed bills are trying to do would not be possible.
So you have the children of three prominent civil rights leaders who have condemned Georgia's business leaders for their silence on the voter suppression efforts. They wrote a joint letter. They are Bernice King, the daughter of Dr. Martin Luther King. They are Al Vivian, the son of Reverend C.T. Vivian, and John Miles Lewis, the son of the late Atlanta Congress member John Lewis. In that letter, they said the failure of corporate leaders across our state to live up to their racial equity commitments made in the last year disregards and disrespects our father's tireless work and jeopardizes the soul of Georgia and the promise of democracy. If you can talk about the significance of this, and then is Black Voters Matter supporting a corporate boycott? I know there is a division within the pro-democracy community in Georgia. Stacey Abrams not yet there for calling for this corporate and state boycott, but religious leaders yesterday coming out, holding a news conference in Atlanta, calling for a corporate boycott.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you read that letter and that you put it together with that question about boycott, because, you know, it's important to note, you know, the role that those leaders, the role that the spiritual community, that our church community played, you know, in the previous iterations of the civil rights movement, right? Previous boycotts, you know, of course, we're all familiar with the Montgomery bus boycott and connecting that to this current question of boycott, because, you know, at the end of the day, and there's something to be said about boycotts require sacrifice, right? Any of our friends in the labor movement can tell us about that, right? But at the end of the day, we're already experiencing the economic consequences, right? We're already experiencing the economic repercussions of Jim Crow, of structural racism, right? And so the question isn't whether or not we're going to face some kind of consequences or if there's going to be some kind of backlash in terms of like jobs and economic growth. We're already experiencing that. And so, you know, we're always in a situation of having to choose between do we take the sacrifices, you know, even when you look at the protests of the summer, the question was, you know, do we risk our lives by going out and doing protests against police violence in the midst of a pandemic? Or do we sit back and we not do anything and we just continue to suffer the pain and the trauma and the death that comes from police violence? Even during the election season, we face the same choice. Do we risk our lives in the midst of a pandemic in order to go out and vote in the face of all this voter suppression? Or do we take these chances and we wait in the long lines? And Georgia voters did that, you know, and literally shocked the country. But we had to make this choice. We always have these choices to make because at the end of the day, our daily lives are facing the economic consequences of Jim Crow and structural racism. And so, you know, we make the case, or I'm making the case that, you know, we're not calling, our coalition here has not called for a boycott, but nor are we saying, except for the clergy, which are a part of the coalition, they stood out and they said, no, we want to go on with the boycott. And I clap for them. We support them, right? We're there with them. We're not going to tell anybody to not boycott. And I think that's the difference in the debate that you raise, is that, you know, we're not calling for it, but we're not standing in the way of it. And if some of our friends and colleagues or individuals even do it, then we support that. We support the Major League Baseball Players Association and the debate about whether or not the All-Star game should be moved from Georgia. In fact, we're going to be reaching out to some other sports leagues and conferences and organizations that are going to be traveling to states like Georgia and Texas and reaching out and saying, look, you see what's going on. And so, yes, there is this debate. And I think at the heart of the debate, what we all have in common, and this is important because it's not a thing where, you know, there's a major fight going on, because what we all have in common is that however we structure a boycott or however we structure calls for companies or leagues to not travel to Georgia or Texas or someplace else, that we've got to do it in a way where we're cognizant, where we're aware, and we're thinking about what the repercussions can be. We believe you can have the best of both worlds, right? We believe that if the All-Star game doesn't come to Georgia, guess what? Some of those resources that they might have put in Georgia, they can still send to Georgia to support getting photo IDs, right, in case we don't repeal this Act to support some of the mobilization that's going to need to take place. So it's not as if saying that you're not going to travel here, it means that you're not going to support those marginalized and vulnerable communities that at the end of the day are going to be most impacted by the voter suppression.
Cliff Allbright, I want to thank you so much for being with us, co-founder and executive director of Black Voters Matter. Coming up, Oregon Governor Kate Brown on her efforts to expand vote by mail, a practice used in Oregon for decades. Stay with us.
Things will never be the same. Just the way it is. Oh, yeah.
We gotta make a change. It's time for us as a people to start making some changes. Let's change the way we eat, let's change the way we live, and let's change the way we treat each other. You see, the old way wasn't working, so it's on us to do what we gotta do to survive. And still I see no changes. Can a brother get a little peace? It's war on the streets and a war in the Middle East. Instead of war on poverty, they got a war on drugs so the police can bother me. And I ain't never did a crime I ain't have to do. But now I'm back with the facts, giving it back to you. Don't let them jack you up, back you up, crack you up, and pimp smack you up. You gotta learn to hold your own. They get jealous when they see you with your mobile phone. But tell the cops I can't touch this. I don't trust this. When they try to rush, I bust this. That's the sound number two. You say it ain't cool. But it raised no fool. And as long as I stay black, I got a stage strap. And I never get to lay back, cause I always got to worry about the payback. Some buck that I roughed up way back. Coming back after all.
Changes by Tupac Shakur featuring Talent. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at voting rights, we turn now to the fight over voting by mail. Republican lawmakers across the country are moving to make it harder for voters to cast ballots by mail, even though some states have safely conducted elections by mail for years. On Thursday, Texas's state Senate passed a sweeping voter suppression bill that includes a provision to make it illegal for local election officials to send vote-by-mail applications to voters, even if they qualify. Joining us now is Oregon's Democratic Governor Kate Brown. She's the national chair of Vote From Home. She served as governor since 2015. Oregon was first state in the country to institute voting by mail and to establish automatic voter registration. 92% of eligible Oregonians are now registered to vote. Governor Brown, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about what Oregon has done all of these years, the safety of voting from home in terms of voter fraud, and the attack on it now?
Thanks, Amy. I so appreciate the opportunity to be on the program this morning. Oregon led the country several decades ago with the passage of an initiative to enable Oregon voters to vote by mail, vote from home. And so we've been voting by mail since the late 1990s, and it's extremely successful. It's successful because Oregon voters find it convenient, and in this state, we believe that your vote is your voice, and every single voice matters. So our efforts, both from Democratic side and the Republican side, have been to ensure access to this very fundamental right, because we believe that democracy works better when every eligible American, every eligible Oregonian can participate. In addition to that, Oregon led the way with our automatic voter registration bill. That was legislation I crafted when I was Secretary of State. We now have over 92% of Oregonians registered, which is extraordinary. And Oregon is, frankly, the most accessible state to vote in the country. The automatic voter registration is really groundbreaking, and over 17 states have followed our lead. But the goal here is to make it as convenient and accessible to register as possible. And frankly, you go get your driver's license here in the state, and you are automatically registered to vote. You can certainly decline if you choose to, but it puts the burden on Oregonians that don't wish to participate, and that's exactly how it should be in a democracy. But it's really been a paradigm shift. All of the organizations, from the League of Women Voters to our student association groups to student organizations like the Bus Project. All of these organizations are now spending their time to educate, to engage, and to empower voters across the state. All of the resources that went into voter registration are now being used to engage voters. And that's the right paradigm shift.
Arizona, Iowa, can you talk about the efforts to suppress voting by mail there?
These are efforts in states like Iowa and states like Georgia and states like Arizona to shut out voices of eligible voters. And it's both racist, it's un-American, and it's undemocratic, and it should be unacceptable. And that's why I'm supporting both H.R. 1 and H.R. 4 in the U.S. Congress. I think it's critically important that our federal elected officials take action to preserve the very fundamental right to vote. But these actions are because conservatives, because Republicans don't want to hear voices. They don't want to hear Black voices. They don't want to hear Brown voices. They don't want to hear Indigenous voices. They don't want to hear women's voices. We have to do everything we can. We have to hold these legislators who voted for these racist policies. We have to hold them accountable. And I'm so delighted to be participating in our Vote From Home organization, because we're going to do exactly that. And we're going to continue to engage and empower voters in these states and make sure that their voices can be heard.
Before we go, Kate Brown, I wanted to ask you about the significance of this week. It's the first week of the Derek Chauvin trial, accused of murdering Floyd George, murdering George Floyd. Protesters in Portland took to the streets for more than three straight months following his death. And in response to the protests last year, Donald Trump tweeted, "Anarchists, agitators, or protesters who vandalize or damage our federal courthouse in Portland or any federal buildings in any of our cities or states will be prosecuted under our recently reenacted Statues and Monuments Act, minimum 10 years in prison. Don't do it," he tweeted. Contrast this response to how he and the Republicans have responded to the insurrectionists in the Capitol on January 6th.
Well, shame on him. It is appalling, the hypocrisy, the corruption, and of course, the chaos of the Trump administration. In Oregon, we support the right of folks to peacefully protest. And honestly, given what is happening in legislatures across the country, we have to use every tool we can to hold legislators accountable. I also am working with my local elected officials to make sure that folks who do not protest peacefully, who commit arson or property damage, are held accountable as well. Shame on Donald Trump.
This past summer in Portland, Oregon, a 100-day protest that we saw against the racism and police brutality that culminated in a death squad-style assassination by U.S. Marshals of the anti-fascist activist Michael Reinel. Can you talk about this?
Absolutely. The actions of the Trump administration were abysmal and absolutely abhorrent in this state. And we worked with our local law enforcement to eradicate these forces from our state. We want to make sure that Oregonians can continually to peacefully protest, to uphold those voices that ask for change. And we will continue to support those efforts to eradicate racism from our institutions, from our structures, and from our systems.
And do you condemn that death squad-style assassination of this man? And have you called for an investigation?
Look, what happened last summer was abhorrent. We are continuing to work to hold federal officials accountable. I expect you will see changes in leadership of local federal officials here in the state of Oregon that is appropriate. and we are glad to be rid of Donald Trump's corruption, chaos, and frankly, incompetent governance.
Well, Kate Brown, I want to thank you for being with us. Governor of Oregon, National Chair of Vote From Home. When we come back, we look at the political and pandemic crisis in Brazil. We'll speak with Celso Amorim, who served as Brazil's foreign minister under Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Stay with us.
Sem porteira, abre e fecha sozinho o invisível portão. Como a gente faz descer? Sai debaixo da relva e mastiga as estrelas.
The Brazilian band Fellini here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show in Brazil, where the death toll from COVID-19 has topped 325,000, with over 66,000 deaths in the month of March. On Wednesday, Brazil reported nearly 3,900 new COVID deaths, breaking the record set one day earlier. In Sao Paulo, Brazil's largest city, gravediggers have been speeding up efforts to empty old graves to make room for the soaring number of COVID-19 deaths. As the number of COVID cases soar, Brazil is also facing a major crisis on the political front. Earlier this week, the heads of Brazil's army, Navy and Air Force all quit in an unprecedented move a day after Brazil's far-right president, Jair Bolsonaro, ousted his defense minister as part of a broader cabinet shakeup. The developments have alarmed many in Brazil who believe Bolsonaro, who is a former army captain, will install ultra-loyalists to the military post to consolidate his power ahead of next year's election, when he's expected to be challenged by former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva of the left-wing Workers' Party. Lula had been expected to defeat Bolsonaro back in 2018, but during the campaign, he was arrested and jailed for nearly 600 days under disputed charges filed by a judge, Sergio Moro, who later became Bolsonaro's justice minister. Well, last month, the Brazilian judge annulled all convictions against Lula, paving the way for him to run again. Brazil's Supreme Court has also ruled that Sergio Moro was biased in convicting Lula. We go now to Rio de Janeiro, where we're joined by the longtime Brazilian diplomat, Celso Amorim. He served as Brazil's foreign minister under Lula, as well as defense minister under Dilma Rousseff. We welcome you back to Democracy Now! Thanks so much for being with us. If you can start off by talking about these the turmoil in Brazil right now, the ouster of the various heads of the army, of the Air Force, and the pandemic that is raging through Brazil right now.
Well, I think you described very well the pandemic as the biggest tragedy Brazil has ever faced. As you know, we never were involved in big wars. I mean, we sent troops to Europe against Nazism, but that was towards the end of the war. And we had the last war we had was more than 150 years ago here in the region. So this is really the biggest tragedy Brazil has ever faced. And that, of course, has affected the popularity of Bolsonaro at the same day that he sacked the Minister of Defense, which led to the dismissal of the army chiefs. At that same day, he had already been forced, in a way, to dismiss the foreign minister because the Senate revolted against the foreign minister and his actions that were detrimental to the search of vaccines and things like that. So we are facing an enormous crisis. Bolsonaro's popularity is sinking, although he has some sort of fanatical support, not very unlike what happens with Trump, in a way. So I think he did that because, of course, these military top brass were not willing to follow on some authoritarian measures like declaring state of emergency or state of siege, which could be the, let us say, the preamble to some sort of dictatorship, to some sort of coup d'etat. Well, I think, I mean, in a word, I think Bolsonaro wished to show his authority. He did that, but he increased the tension with the military. So, in a way, although he gained some time in terms of the opposition of public opinion, which might even lead to his impeachment, we don't know. But although he gained some time, I think he's smaller. He's ever smaller. But at the same time, as he becomes smaller in terms of support, of broad classes. Of course, he was very much linked to Trump as well, so that makes a difference. At the same time, he becomes more dangerous. So that's the situation we are living. And in contrast with that, as it was pointed out, we had the good news that the Supreme Court canceled all the charges against President Lula, who is appearing, as you know, not only nationally but internationally. And he is, of course, normally a great figure that will either be a candidate himself or have a big influence in the elections next year. So this is the situation you're living now in the midst of some hope in the political field and, of course, some fears, very big tragedy in the health area and some fear also because of this turmoil, as you described it.
So you have, what, the fourth health minister that Bolsonaro has appointed during the pandemic. And also, of course, Bolsonaro, as you said, very much seen as the Trump of the tropics, really pushing hydroxychloroquine, denigrating face masks and calling the COVID a little flu.
Yes, that's true. And of course, in the beginning, maybe some people were hesitating to be sure whether that was what that would work. But now it's absolutely clear what happened. He denied science, as Trump did, but I think he did in a more militant way, confronting governors, confronting actually one of the possible reasons for the displeasure of Bolsonaro with his military chiefs was precisely their resistance to some actions that related to the governors, because some governments have declared curfew and taken other measures of social distancing, including some form of lockdown. And Bolsonaro was—he even spoke publicly about the possibility of having a state of siege, as if you were in an external war, to face to confront the authority of the state governors. And that, of course, is a very serious problem in Brazil from every point of view. Not only left-wing; I mean, some of them are center-right. But he's obsessed with the possibility of his impeachment on the one hand, and with the declining popularity in relation to the possible election on the other hand. So I think that's how he
Councilman Marim, I wanted to turn to former Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who you served under, speaking last month about Bolsonaro's response to COVID-19.
Many of the COVID deaths could have been avoided if there were a government who did their job. This country is disorganized and falling apart because it has no government. There was a president who invented chloroquine, a president who said that those who were scared of COVID are sissies, that COVID was just a little flu, that COVID was something for cowards, that he was a former athlete and it would not affect him. That is not the role of a president of the republic in a civilized country.
Lula went on to say Brazil is falling apart under Bolsonaro's government.
This country is disorganized and falling apart because it has no government. I will repeat, this country has no government. And with fake news, the world elected former President Donald Trump. And with fake news, the world elected Bolsonaro.
We interviewed Lula just before he went to prison. Now a judge has cleared the convictions against him. He served hundreds of days in prison. Talk about the significance of Lula now out. Will he be running for president? And what this means, where you see Brazil needs to go right now?
Well, you know, even Lula himself is concentrating his attention in the present situation that you described from the health point of view, but it's also big unemployment. People, Brazil is a poor country, much poorer than the United States, so you can imagine what happens to people that don't have jobs, that don't know where to go. So the need for emergency help for poor workers, for informal workers, is one of the main points that Lula has been insisting. I think if we 2022 is still a bit far away in some respects, not in terms, not chronologically maybe, but I mean the hurdles that we have to surmount this year in terms of the health tragedy that we are going through, in terms of the unemployment, in terms of the lack of income for the poor people, all these are the priorities for Lula now. Of course, it's impossible to escape from the realities of politics. And I think from our point of view, I would say from the point of view of the more progressive forces in Brazil, the fact that we have this election and we have that horizon, it gives us energy. But I have to say also that I was worried, as I said, with this. It's very uncommon in Brazil. I think it never happened to have the defense minister and the three chiefs of the army sacked in the same day, that the foreign minister was also sacked. You mentioned it was a cabinet reform, but it was a cabinet reform of sorts, because really his intention, he was forced to take away the foreign minister, was a fanatic of the extreme right, and he was and he decided to take to dismiss the army chiefs and the three chiefs of the armed forces. So I think this is in itself a crisis. But apparently what I think is his main objective was to gain time, to show authority, to continue on the race. What will be his next step, we never know, because Bolsonaro is really totally unpredictable. One day he says, well, no, I don't want to fight the anything. The other day he's asking his top general to criticize the decision of the Supreme Court you referred to before. And so we never know. We never know how much. I mean, he has said we are on the verge of chaos. Which president in the world says that we are in the verge of chaos, except if he himself wants to create chaos? So I think this is really the situation we are living. It's a very difficult situation, but there is a broader consciousness in society, including the economic sectors, bankers, and financial sectors who supported Bolsonaro, or at least some of them supported, but some tolerated Bolsonaro, and they are now more critical. And he feels that, of course, and under this pressure, we never know what kind of action he can take.
So, Kelso Amorim, you're the former foreign secretary under Lula of Brazil. Can you talk about the Biden administration, Joe Biden's approach to foreign policy in Latin America? Already, he seems to be following, when it comes to Brazil, very much, though he is different in many ways, the same track as Trump, promoting heavy U.S. intervention in the region. His government has asked, has also backed Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido as the president of Venezuela rather than the democratically elected Nicolas Maduro. What is your response to that?
Well, let me say one thing. We took Joe Biden's election with a sigh of relief. Yeah, that was very important in many respects. And I still think in many respects, and it's not your question, but I must say that because the United States has a kind of influence that goes beyond what actually they do in foreign policy. I mean, in the moves in internal in the society in the United States in relation to economic relief, in relation to combating racism, to many of these questions, inequality, it's very much what we would like to see happening in Brazil. So this is a very positive side in a way, because the United States doesn't have influence beyond what it actually does, but in terms of foreign policy. But in terms of foreign policy, I'm not speaking of Russia, Europe, that's another matter, or China, I might speak, but that's another question. But in relation to Latin America, I must say I'm a bit disappointed. of course, the United States has other things, the Biden administration has maybe other things to concentrate on. But I, for instance, I was particularly disappointed with the move, with the declaration of the foreign secretary in relation to Bolivia, because he, in a way, questioned the Bolivian judicial system to defend a lady who was an imposter, actually, and who violated human rights in the bluntest possible way. So it gives the impression that it's the same kind of policy, and this obsession with the influence of China and Russia obscures the view of what is democracy and what is... I'm not saying that he should favor Venezuela or Cuba, but at least take some humanitarian action, something that shows that they are not pursuing the same line of sanctions or threats of military intervention would be good. And this statement, that was only a statement, but a statement of the United States Secretary of State takes a lot of weight in Latin America. This statement about Bolivia was really regrettable. So I think change, which came to the United States in many respects, didn't come yet to the diplomacy in relation to Latin America.
What do you want to see him doing, whether it comes to Cuba, to Bolivia, to Brazil, your own country?
Well, Brazil is a very special case now. It's very difficult. I think I would hope that he can support human rights in Brazil, support sustainable development in Brazil. But the way he does that, of course, we don't want foreign intervention either. But I think it's important that they show that if Brazil wants to have a good and constructive dialogue with the United States, it also has to behave according to civilization norms that are applied everywhere.
And Blinken recognizing Juan Guaido as the president who wasn't elected?
This is regrettable. This is totally regrettable. If you might say, it's silly, too, because it has no future. It has no future. It didn't have any future with Trump. We would all support it. It won't have any future now. Some kind of dialogue must be open with Maduro. I don't know. You don't need to support Maduro, but you have to dialogue to... That's what we did, actually, back in 2003, with full support of the Republicans. With Colin Powell, who used to talk to me about a group of friends of Venezuela when we act that way. And in relation to Cuba, the sanctions are something totally obscure. It's still the Cold War mentality, which has nothing to do. It doesn't need to be friends with Cuba, but, I mean, just to respect international law and not have unilateral sanctions and embargoes would be very positive. And this declaration on Bolivia was really very, very much worrying because it points into the wrong direction. Instead of, so you say, what should he do in relation to Latin America? Well, Obama, in some respects, try to work in a better way in relation to Cuba. Even with Venezuela, they had indirect dialogues. And certainly, for instance, he asked for a dialogue with the organization that we have of South American countries. I participated in that, so I know. So I think more respect. I think what the United States has to understand that there is diversity in Latin America, and diversity and plurality, and of course, a desire to work independently, to cooperate with the United States, of course. For instance, one thing he should do is change the president of the chairman or president of the Inter-American Bank, who is someone who is a hawkish figure, put there by Trump. I don't know for what. It's an extreme right wing that we never had. It has always been a Latin America, but more important than being a Latin America or being a U.S. citizen is the question of understanding Latin America and not making the Latin America the stage for a new Cold War that we don't want to be involved with.
And
so I think that.
And finally, your comment on the U.S. and other wealthy members of the World Trade Organization blocking a push by developing countries to waive patent rights in an effort to boost the ability to get vaccines out to the world.
Well, I was very much involved in a similar situation some 15 years ago. That was a Republican government, and we were able to discuss it's very famous, the Doha Declaration on Trips and Health, which is part even of the Agenda 2030 of the United Nations and so on and
we
so forth.
We just have 10
so
seconds.
I really regret this position of the United States. I think it's not... you can't be look for social justice internally and play egoistically in the international scenario. I think the pandemic is a world problem, and I think you have to facilitate the access to medicines and to vaccines above all, in an equitable way. And
Kelso Amorim, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Sorry we've run out of time. Brazil's former foreign minister and defense minister. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a senior news producer to join our news team here in New York City. Check it out at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.